Today is September 5th, 1974, and this is Minnie Sussman interviewing Leon Falk in his office, continuing where our conversation from several weeks ago. Leon, your family has contributed so very, very much to not only Pittsburgh, but to the world. Be very interested in something about your origins, where your family came from, who were the first ones to come? Did they come immediately to Pittsburgh? Did they immediately go into the steel business? Can you give me some of those things?
Well, my grandfather, Falk, was named Charles Falk. And I don't know how true the story is, but I've always been told that he and his bride, Sarah Falk, came over on a boat about 1870, and she fell off the gangplank in New York Harbor and would never get on a boat again. And they first went to Greensburg. And
excuse me for interrupting. They came from where?
From the Rhine Valley in Germany, right near Frankfurt, a little town called Erpel.
U-R-P-A-L?
E-R-P-A-L, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay, they then went to Germany, to Greensburg.
And not having planned on staying here, he set up a tailor shop there. I think part of the children were born in Greensburg, and then he moved to Pittsburgh.
How many children were there?
There were seven.
Seven?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who they were? Can you remember their names?
Well, I can all... Let's see, there was Tilly, Morris, and Carrie, and Leon, and Sigo, and Jesse, and Amy. Is that seven?
That's right.
Yeah, that's us. And I think the last couple were born in Pittsburgh.
That would be Jesse and Amy?
I'm still guessing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I know my father taught high school in Greensburg.
Where did he go to school?
He went to the high school there, and then he put in a year at W&J when he went to work. And Uncle Morris had a brother-in-law in Pittsburgh by the name of Henry Weisskopf. That was Laura's brother-in-law. And he came in and went into business with him, smelting secondary metals. That is, taking scrap copper and recovering it. And the same with brass. And after a few years, that's what brought my father into Pittsburgh. He joined him. That was the Duquesne Reduction Company.
Your father was married when he came to Pittsburgh, or did he marry after?
Afterwards.
Whom did he marry?
He married a Fanny Edel from Richmond, and he met her when he went down there as best man for a wedding of somebody else.
What year was that?
I guess it was 1899, something like that. And they were a southern family that my grandfather's Fidel came from, they were also German background, but they were Myers and Adels, and the Myers part lived in Savannah, Georgia, where two brothers were there. It was Sigo, Sigo and Herman. And Herman was the mayor of Savannah around 1902, 1903. And Sigo was president of the First National Bank of Savannah. And my grandfather, Adele, was in the paper box business in Lynchburg, Virginia. They weren't very keen about my father coming from the North marrying my mother, but apparently that came off all right. She was an only child, and grandfather and grandmother Adele then moved to Pittsburgh when after they were married. He set up a paper box business here.
Is that paper box business still in existence?
I don't think so. The big companies have taken that number. But they used to supply the department stores for boxes.
And how many children then did your parents have?
Well, those seven children, there was only three ever born. There was my sister and myself and Liam. And Tilly had a child that died when she was...
Tilly had married whom?
She married Meyer Forrest.
Oh.
And then after Tilly died, the family decided that Jesse ought to marry. That's the way the German family did. So he was married to two sisters. They didn't consult him, you know.
It was just arranged.
Yeah.
And Morris never had any children.
He had one that died, but Laura had a, she lost her leg as a result. I don't know what happened, but it was born and never lived.
Oh, that's right. Wasn't one of the Falk memorials in memory of...
No, my mother.
Oh, I thought of a daughter, young. Oh, your mother, young.
There was very little ever said about this child.
Oh, I see. And then, so your parents, were you the oldest of the children?
And Margie, that's all there were in the whole family.
And
so it was, we were pampered and spoiled.
No, I wouldn't say that you were.
No, we were.
In what way?
Well, we were the only kids in the family.
Yeah, but how were you pampered and spoiled?
Well, we just were. Anyway, any child could be pampered and spoiled.
But do you think that that had an effect and an influence on your life? I mean, here you are.
That had the biggest influence on my life was my mother dying when I was 9 and Margie was 6. The result was I became very close to my father, who had really high ideals. And the other thing that affected me was Dr. Levy, who was his good friend, J. Leonard Levy. We used to travel together, and that's where the first memorial was built out at Rhoda Hill. It was for my mother. That was before there were swimming pools and gymnasiums in the schools. He had an idea he could tie the kids to Rhoda Hill by having a center there.
I was so happy when they built the new addition to see them transport the library in toto with all that beautiful paneling and that portrait of your mother still remaining in there. Then, Leon, you married, and whom did you marry and from where?
I married a Baltimore girl by the name of Catherine Sonneborn. We had five children.
When did you marry?
26.
And you had the five children.
Mm-hmm.
And they are?
And then we were divorced.
What are the names of your children?
Ellen, Morgan, right, or Ellen, Sarah, Sigo, David, and Susan.
And then you and Kitty were divorced.
We were divorced after World War II. We just pulled apart.
And did you remarry?
Yeah, I remarried your sister about a year later. And she died.
When did she die?
49, I think. We were only married a few years.
Did Josephine die that early in 1949?
Oh, wait a minute, I get my arithmetic. 70, Lonnie and I have been married 12 years. That would be 62. We were married. Josephine must have died
in
about 59. Something like that.
And did Josephine have children?
She had children, but not by we didn't have any.
But you had a close relationship with her children, didn't you?
Yeah, we more or less all grew up together.
Together.
And it was half a family arrangement.
Yeah. Well, I think
Kitty went to Israel. She was mostly very much drawn there. Josephine's family were in Bedford. They were divorced. So it was just kind of a family arrangement. It worked out all right.
Perfect. Well, they were both very, very fine people. Leon, now as to your childhood home, I remember you saying, our first interview, that you grew up in the East End, around Pacific or Atlantic. Would that be the East End? What part was?
That was the other car line when we were family moved there.
And what was the?
That was the same as where it was
today.
It was half Jewish and half Christian.
And
Uncle Morris lived on Graham Street. Of course, live on Rebecca, and we lived on Atlanta, three consecutive blocks.
And in your home, were there what kind of life was it in your home? Oh, was there much relationship between parents and children? Was there much talking going on? What kind of influences did you have?
It was a regular German family.
Yeah.
And the grandparents were there, and when my mother died, my aunt Carrie Wolf, who had no children, they moved in the Keith house. When my mother died, both her parents died within a year. And so then Aunt Carrie moved in. I got along with her all right, but Marjorie didn't.
Carrie
Wolf.
Carrie Wolf.
That was my father's older sister. They had no children.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very interrelated family because Aunt Jessie's husband, Forrest, and Max Wolf were partners in the scrap business.
Oh.
So.
And then I can see why you say you were spoiled. Then all of the dreams and all of the aspirations and all of the love were placed in with you.
Yeah, we were the only two. And my father's parents lived on Rebecca Street,
mm-hmm.
and Jesse kept house for them. And so every Friday night, the whole family had to gather there.
Was there a religious influence in the home?
Some. Not the grandparents were very much so.
But Reformed Jews or Orthodox?
They didn't know what they were. They came from Europe. And,
yeah.
The rest of the family were Reformed. They had to have a kosher meal once in a while.
No. Couldn't quite throw off the old habits.
My grandmother, for Friday night, she had to prepare the meal herself. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So it was a considerable Jewish influence.
Mm-hmm. Was that the influence you think that influenced you in this very major role that you played in helping found Temple Sinai?
No, that was another story altogether. I just felt that we got too reformed, and I could see people pulling away from...
You mean Rhoda Phillum got too reformed?
Yeah, it got cold, you know what I mean? It got so intellectual and it got so big that it wasn't just me. There was a movement, you know, to form more Reformed congregations. And Dave Blick, I guess, was one of the ones that wanted to do it. And Lou Kaplan and a half a dozen of us decided we'd be the guinea pigs and start another congregation. I was on the board and I resigned, and I forget who else it was.
Mm-hmm. Did you then did you feel that the Temple Sinai was offering a warmth and
a
closeness?
Well, that's what we wanted. Mm-hmm. And maybe I had some little personal resentments that had been fostered by my father's friends like Russ Lander and some of them on account of the way the Fall Memorial had been handled.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I was influenced
that
way,
too.
You don't need to put that...
No, I'm not. But the thing, I find it interesting...
It's worked out all right. Okay.
That there are very few facets of this community into which you have not played a role. Now, when you went to school at the public schools, I think you told me, you went to Friendship?
Friendship. I went to Shenley High. Played for 6 months.
Yeah.
Then I went to private school. Went to Exeter and then to Yale. Friendship School in those days was half black and half white. The ones that came from across 10th Avenue were black, and there was very little mingling, I'll tell you that.
Very little mingling. At Yale, what was your school? Was it engineering or liberal arts or what?
I mean, at college.
Yeah.
No, I was a chemical engineer and also a metallurgist. I was a chef, Sheffield Scientific School.
Oh.
No, I never even learned how to spell.
I was reading that about Rockefeller, that he never could learn to spell or read either, and it didn't seem to harm him at all. In terms of your home, you said it was a German home, therefore was there a very strict discipline?
The oldest in the family, Uncle Morris, called it him.
Oh, he ran even your home?
Sure. My father was the younger brother. Uncle Morris pretty well called it too. He and I had a very close relationship. When my father died, which was a good many years later, I said to him then, I said, look, you and I are going to be friends, and we're going to have our office together, and I have no desire to inherit anything from you, because I don't need it, and that will avoid any kind of conflict between us. And we had a wonderful relationship for years.
Perfect.
So that worked.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that your father had high ideals, that you had become very close to him and you were greatly influenced by his high ideals. What were those ideals?
Well, he had a very high ethical standard. And he was a very kind man. I didn't like my Aunt Laura at all. And he used to make me go over there and he'd say, "Now look, she's a cripple, she lost her leg, and she's unpleasant to you, you can't pay any attention." She was a mean person, and she made the most of her infirmity.
Mm-hmm. It's been known to happen. And have those ideals been the things that have tried that have influenced you in your approach to life,
and
the kinds of things
now
that you have tried to do?
And
were these the kinds of things then that you tried to hand on to your children? Were these the kinds
of
things?
No, I haven't passed it on at all. I've been a very poor father. I've been interested in the Jewish community and that sort of thing, but I was too busy to be a good father. As a matter of fact, Kitty didn't pass much on either.
Mm-hmm. I think that this sometimes becomes the concern of our generation, that we did this to our children an awful lot.
We were too busy, and we allowed a governess to raise the children.
I wanted to ask this, then. Do you see this, then, being reflected in your children?
Yeah.
What about your children doing with their children?
Parents. They're with them all the time.
Isn't that interesting?
I'm sure there's a considerable resentment against both of us.
But they're making up for it then with their children.
I have good relationship with children now. They've gotten old enough.
And did you know then, Leon, this is, maybe the important thing is, I think that at our ages, this is when it becomes more important, when we do begin to have a relationship with our children. It's more important today than it was when we began.
If you can get over the resentments.
Yes.
Look at Vicky Skate. Both he and Cordy grew up with Ellen.
Yeah.
And they were raised by governesses. They have terrific resentments against their parents. Vicky's even taken the name of Ellen out of the Sarah Skate Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not uncommon.
Oh, no. definitely not. Have you noticed, then, we talked about then one difference. You're noticing the difference between your way your children are raising their children and the different kinds of disciplines in the home. Would you say that there are any other major differences in life today and life when you were younger in terms of the city? In terms of the economic attitudes, in terms of, let's take in terms of you as a power in this city. Is there a difference in the attitude of you today and, for instance, your Uncle Morris or your father in those days and their feelings about the city?
Well, when you start talking about Pittsburgh, I think that Leland Hazard wrote it up very well the other day.
I didn't happen to read it. What did he say? In relationship to this thing of Pittsburgh, is there a difference between your feeling and your contemporaries about your role in Pittsburgh and that of your father and your uncle and their generation about Pittsburgh?
No, I carried over theirs, but there's a difference now.
What was their feeling?
They were proud of Pittsburgh. They felt very grateful to the Mellon family. And as a matter of fact, they, like a lot of Pittsburghers, looked to the Mellon family for leadership. And after they were gone, when World War II started and Dick Mellon started the Renaissance here, I was glad to be included, as were a great many other people, when the Allegheny Conference was formed. platform, but they did the leading. And the whole redevelopment of downtown Pittsburgh was really Dick Mellon through some very capable people like Van Busker and Leland Hazard and others. And this was the final thing that was done, was that fountain.
The fountain at the Point.
At the Point. And he talks, I'll just read you a little bit, see.
This is from Leland Hazard's article.
Some great and good things have come to Pittsburgh since the high days of the Allegheny Conference. Heinz Hall is beautifully reconstructed and lovely, but is a departure from the early plan for a cultural center in the Lower Hill, due, of course, to the lack in transit development. The new Sarah's Cave Gallery, Museum of Art, Carnegie Institute will belatedly begin to compensate for the omissions of the past, the loss of Aaronsburg and Thompson collections. Even in the magnificent Sarah's Cave Gallery and the new Worthy collection, there is evidence of a new order, Sarah in parenthesis, Mellon Scaife, was the sister of R.K. and her beneficiaries used to be in the name of Sarah Mellon Scaife. Pittsburgh seems all right. We all say so in print and in song and dance, but we are protesting too much. There's a smell of decay in the mayor's office, an air of confusion in the county commissioner's office, and a sense of lost direction in the Allegheny Conference. That sums it up. And that's a fact.
Well, would you say, I had read somewhere that the founding fathers of Pittsburgh, I mean the Mellons and Carnegies, that their only interest in Pittsburgh was to take money out of Pittsburgh, not to put money into Pittsburgh.
Until Dick came along. Andy.
And that made that began then the big change.
And guys like Sansford Bowman that made people proud of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody doing that today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sitting here reading the program for the Allegheny Conference now. It's just so much drivel.
They don't have any plans for it.
No one cares. We used to have these dreamers that would think up things to do with Pittsburgh, and they could go to Dick Mellon, and Dick would hammer them through.
Was Edgar Kaufman one of the dreamers?
Edgar Kaufman played a very big role in it, yes.
In what way?
Well, he had access to Dick Mellon. He was on the Allegheny Conference, and he was mentioned down there in the he was mentioned down there as one of the people that helped the Pittsburgh Renaissance.
Well, why do you think there's been this change? I mean, why the indifference?
I'll tell you why. Because all our companies today are headed by hired men. I won't be quoted on this.
No.
They're all hired men.
Mm-hmm.
And Dick wasn't the hired man. Dick inherited great wealth. And he had the companies headed by hired men who did what he told them.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the vision. That's the difference. This town's dead today. Completely dead.
That's fascinating. Never thought of that. Now, and you don't
all
think...
When I go there now, the heads of the big companies are there. All they're thinking really about is how to keep their company running.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then that you mean that they too then are rootless.
They're not ruthless. They're
rootless. Where they have no foundations themselves.
Rootless.
Rootless.
Yeah, they've been brought in from out of town, most of them.
Mm-hmm.
The one guy I'm placing a lot of hope in is Jim Higgins.
Who's he?
He's the head of the Mellon Bank today.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And his father was a doctor here. And he left Pittsburgh and went down to National City Bank in New York. And Frank Denton brought him back. And I think he has enough vision about Pittsburgh and enough power in his hands that he can influence a great deal in this area for redevelopment. I think he's the only hope I see. We we happen to be good friends. And I have him very much interested in the health center.
Well, that's...
My father hasn't been a doctor.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the health center. I wonder if you could tell me something about it and how it started, why it started, how it started, and what it was like at the beginning and how it's developed in terms of interest and expansion.
Well, the health center, I can give you pretty... That was Dr. Bowman's dream. And Dr. Bowman, when he came to Pittsburgh, had been the head of the College of Surgeons under...
the Mayos?
I'm no good in names anymore. Up in...
The Mayos?
The Mayos.
The Mayos.
Yeah. Under Will Mayo. And he wanted to build a health center here and have a top medical setup. And after he got the university moved out to Oakland, he moved it, you know. It was up on the hill.
Yeah.
He brought it down on the level.
Yeah.
Someone gave the university another part of that hillside, and that's where he wanted to have the health center, and he wanted to get Presbyterian to come over from the north side.
Mm-hmm.
And he and my father had become good friends, and he talked my father and Uncle Morris into putting up the outpatient department, which is a fall clinic.
Oh.
Long before it ever should have been put up, but there weren't any sporting hospitals.
Yeah.
And it's been a pain in the neck, the university, for years. We're just really getting it organized now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they put it up in 28 before the crash came. And then Presby moved out, and then they got the Ioneer to come out. Somebody left some money to the in trust for the Mellon Bank to put up a woman's hospital. There wasn't enough money, and mm-hmm. RK nursed that fund along so they could put up the woman's wing out there. Then there was a terrific fight in the Jewish community. It was led by Isaac Frank and my father on one side and the Orthodox community on the other to bring Montefiore in the health center. It was up on the hill, you know. And they finally compromised it by buying the land next to the health center so at some future date it could come in.
Well, in what way?
The Jewish doctors were afraid.
Oh, they wanted to remain up on the on Center
wanted,
Avenue?
They didn't want a part of the health center because one of the conditions was that you had to be appointed as a professor or teacher in the school in order to get on the staff.
Mm-hmm.
And there had been considerable amount of discrimination against Jewish doctors and Jewish surgeons, and they were afraid to risk themselves. In fact, a lot of them feel that way today. So that's where the health center got started. And then my father died, and Bowman and I had become good friends, and I was put on the board when I was, I think it was 1930 or 31.
How old were you when your father died?
Well, I was born in 1901, so I was 28.
28, and to assume then all of this kind of role?
I had to pick the thing up. I never had any time for my kids.
What were your feelings when you had to assume this leadership role?
I didn't have any feelings. I've been trained for it by my father.
You had no feelings of insecurity, of nervousness or anything of that?
I had Uncle Morris. I talked it over with him. And he didn't like to assume that kind of responsibility, so I was pushed into it.
Well, let me get this.
One day he and Irv Lehman made me president of the Jewish Federation. I think it was 1931. I was a kid then. I was president of that. The next thing, I was head of the United Fund.
Your Uncle Morris then was primarily in business. And your father's interest then, though, was in the community development.
More than Uncle Morris, although Uncle Morris and he worked together.
Together.
But Morris did not like to take the leadership role.
Mm-hmm.
He liked to sit back.
Mm-hmm.
He pulled the strings, all right.
Yeah.
But he didn't like, you know, make a speech or anything
mm-hmm.
like that.
So your development really came from the, from two amazing, strong people, your father and your uncle.
Yeah.
So both two sides of you developed.
I was like a son to both of them.
Yes. Well, did you find that this, that as a result of your being president then of the Federation, the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies, and later the United Jewish Fund, and your role in the city leadership, in the broader general community, that this then really served, as you said, as the bridge and between.
Yeah, that's what I was getting back to talk about before. The men in Pittsburgh who were the Jewish leaders that had money were all involved in industries that brought them in contact with the Christian community.
Mm-hmm.
The late ones with Blahn Ox. Edgar was the only one in the department stores that was involved. I wonder if you could excuse me for a minute.
Yes.
And I'll be back.
Minnie E. Sussman interviewing Mr. Leon Falk, November 23rd, 1974. When we finished taping the last session, you had just assumed, Mr. Falk, leadership at the age of 28 and at the age of 33 had become president of what was then called the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies. Was there the fundraising agency in existence at that time, the United Jewish Fund? This would be in the early 30s, I should imagine, when you came. Can you tell us what it was like at that time?
The Federation of Jewish Philanthropies was a part of the community chest. And we had private drive as well as working for the community chest. And the funds from the community chest went to the Montefiore Hospital, the Jewish Home for the Aged, the Family and Children's, what is the Jewish?
It was then called, I believe, the Jewish Social Service Bureau.
The Jewish Social Service Bureau and a few others.
Mm-hmm.
But the United Fund, or the Community Chest, did not like to have its funds allocated towards the Jewish Free Burial and a few other very strictly Jewish activities, so that there was other funds raised for that purpose. Then the question came up about whether the Federation would join in with the Zionist group in raising funds for the settling of Jews in the British Palestine. British mandated Palestine, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And the old Reformed Jewish families were very much against it. And there was a large Zionist group in Pittsburgh very much for it. The result was that money, that those favoring immigration to Palestine gave their money directly, and those that felt that a Jewish state would interfere with their Americanism wouldn't give. However, after Hitler when did the war start?
Hitler came in 1933, and World War II, our part of it, started in 1941.
But after Hitler became firmly in the saddle, I forget what the date was, there was a reevaluation of the whole picture. The Federation of Jewish Philanthropies finally withdrew most of its agencies from the community chest, including the hospital, since all the hospitals in town felt that the three hospitals in the chest received an undue advantage, one of which was the Montefiore. And several of the agencies did remain and are still in the Unity Chest, now the United Way. However, separate drives were raised for the United Jewish Appeal. It was never included with the Federation, as far as I know.
Then when they withdrew, that was when the United Jewish Fund was started to raise for both local and national and overseas needs.
That's right, except for those funds that were in the community chest.
You mentioned the Hitler period and resettlement, you also had an interest in resettlement of Jews. I wonder if you could tell us about that.
Well, in 1938, Franklin Roosevelt called a meeting in Avion, Switzerland, of 34 nations looking for places to settle Jews and other minorities who were discriminated against in Germany. And the only nation that volunteered to take any, and they volunteered to take 100,000, was the Dominican Republic. As a result of that, incidentally, the United States didn't volunteer to take any. And as a result of that offer, James N. Rosenberg in New York had formed the Dominican Republic Settlement Association, which had status with the Intergovernmental Committee for Refugees. He called into service Dr. Rosen, who had, I'm forgetting his first name. Dr. Rosen, who had settled Jews in the Crimea after World War I, and who had a great deal of know-how for training refugees for new environments. Rosenberg and Rosen went to the Dominican Republic, and the and President Trujillo turned over his turned over his plantation of 25,000 acres as a resettlement center for the refugees. This center known as Sisua. I read about it.
How's that spelled, Sisua?
S-O-S-U-A. S-O-S-U-A.
S-O-S-U-A.
That's exactly the way it's said. I read about it in the New York Times and wanted to take a trip. And my wife and I went down to the Dominican Republic and met Dr. Rosen and his small staff. A couple of days later, he had a stroke. And a few days after that, the first group of settlers were due to arrive from Europe. So I stayed down there and helped the small staff bring in the settlers and move them up to Sisua. Fortunately, Dr. Rosen's son was there and acted as head of the settlement temporarily. My role then became, I became so interested that I decided to be involved with Jimmy Rosenberg. And for 2 years, my wife and I would travel back and forth from the Dominican Republic, doing all kinds of things to be of help. I became friendly with General Trujillo, and it should be noted that he gave me the authority to to go to the State Department every day and ask for visas for refugees to the Dominican Republic. We used to get cables of the names of those in concentration camps that were scheduled to go back to Germany and the